always talk about rewatchability. If afterwards I say to myself, would I want to go see this movie? Virtuoso filmmaking by Scorsese. It's some of the best work he's done.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
We're getting more gifts. Let's start there. We are getting more gifts in the mail from anonymous sources. I finished the Martin Scorsese book by John Sean. I'm just going to assume the publisher, Abrams, has heard of the podcast, has heard that we do Scorsese stories, and sent me the book. It's phenomenal. 276 pages. Big coffee table book. I loved every second of it. I finished it. I implore all of you to go buy it if you have any interest in the greatest director of all time. We're getting more gifts. Now, Sanzik, if you can describe for the audience what I'm holding currently in my hand. What do you see here?
It says movie buff.
It looks like playing cards, doesn't it? It just says movie buff.
They look like playing cards for a 90-year-old.
So I open these up and I go, oh, okay, this is pretty cool. It's probably, I don't play board games or card games, but this kind of maybe get back in that groove of things. But you open it up and it's just like it says take five. Okay, fine. You can go to the other side. It's just like a deck of cards that says quote or reverse angle or actor. And I'm like, hang on a second. I like games like if it was an actual card saying, this actor was a grifter and loves high fidelity, but you always know with him you could say anything. Oh, who is John Cusack? This just basically says, take five. Like, I don't understand what that means. So I haven't even bothered to look at the directions of said game. If it's a trivia game that doesn't actually have trivia questions, not all that interested. But thanks to Movie Buffs, if they need another gift, this will be all Stancer. Go ahead. This is another one.
Oh, you're giving me the bad gifts.
That's right. You have five siblings. You guys just sit around and play Movie Buff, report back, and let me know how this is.
We do play Trivial Pursuit every Christmas.
Now to be replaced by Movie Buff. GoldDerby.com is the number one prognosticating site. That's where I have all my picks for when it comes to the Oscars and the Emmys. So first and foremost, the Emmys. It's not often, Stanzik. 16 of 36 would be considered decent. That was my score on the Emmy predictions. Out of the experts—
Wait, that's good?
Out of the experts who are on that website, including the great Tom O'Neill— Of the 36 categories, number one, I think the person got 20. I actually finished, of the 16 experts listed, with 16 of 36. That's 43%. I finished eighth. Middle of the pack. That's how unpredictable this year's Emmys were, or that's how poor the experts are on GoldDerby.com.
Wait, were they that unpredictable?
Oh, yeah. Because you see Game of Thrones coming, sure. People versus O.J. Simpson, got it.
Yeah, you see Tambor coming. You see Julia Louis-Dreyfus coming. And
sure.
They seem pretty obvious to me.
No, but after that, there's a lot of— Listen. I thought Spacey was going to win for Best Actor. Surprising that my man Rami Malek coming through. Although I was happy to see it. I haven't seen that show, but apparently he's awesome. Rami Malek over Kevin Spacey. Not a lot of us saw coming. House of Cards.
Okay, one surprise.
Listen, once you go through all the categories, I'm telling you, it gets a little bit tricky. By the way, Jimmy Kimmel, the best joke of the night was the Cosby joke. And he says, here he is, Dr. Bill Cosby. And you just see Tina Fey's face just aghast. Everyone just terrified. He's not actually here. I just want to see how you guys would react. Check out my Oscar picks, though. They're goldderby.com. The big favorite right now is La La Land. That won the Audience Award at the Toronto Film Festival. It's going to be opening December 9th, limited release December 16th after that. It's a musical, which admittedly is not a genre I'm a fan of. My friend Tim Kirchner once said to me, you know, what are some famous movies you've never seen? I said, well, I've never seen The Sound of Music. I've never seen Guys and Dolls. He's like, okay, I see a trend here. You don't like musicals. I'm like, I just don't. He goes, is it the fact they just burst into song out of nowhere? I'm like, yeah, that's probably the issue. They just, for no reason, they just start singing in verse. But I will go see La La Land because it's getting tremendous buzz, and I do love Ryan Gosling. Having said that, the big news, December 23rd, Marty's new movie, Silence, has been announced. They said before it was going to come out in November. They just released this yesterday. Release date, December 23rd, following the model of The Revenant, so many other movies. You go limited release, end of December, then you go wide release, January. You suck up all the Oscars. This is a passion project. That, you know, a lot of the movies that Marty's made lately are very proficient and stylistic, and they're great, but they're not passion projects. Wolf of Wall Street's not something that he's like, I got to make that movie. Leo read the book because you're the only guy that can make this. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, 3 hours, men behaving badly. Marty, you can do this. He goes, all right, fine, I'll do it. Becomes a huge hit, ton of money, Oscars, etc. You know, The Aviator is not a film that was come from his heart. It's just like, hey, this is a good story. It'll be interesting. Hugo was given to him by his friend who said, listen, Marty, this is exactly you, Graham King, the producer. Silence, this story is about 17th century Jesuit priests who go to Japan and then face persecution. So this is purely born out of a pure Marty idea. Like he, Gangs of New York was a passion project. For 2 decades, he tried to make that movie. Silence is a movie, he said, for 2 decades he's tried to make this. He couldn't get the financing. Daniel Day-Lewis originally was in the movie. It's now going to be Liam Neeson, Andrew Garfield, and Adam Driver. Cost $51 million, which for his movie is quite paltry. But I can't wait to see it. I know it's probably a tough sell for audiences in December. If it's not, hey, who wants to go see a movie of a Jesuit priest being persecuted in 17th century Japan? What? Martin Scorsese directed. Okay, I'm in. Like December 23rd, I'll be there. So I look forward to that. That, once again, is on goldderby.com. We have a great guest today. Norm Macdonald is hysterical. He is coming up momentarily. He's so funny. We went in a lot of different directions. And I find that Norm is very irreverent. Either you're really all in on his style and it's very idiosyncratic, or you just find him strange and unnerving. Or maybe you find it to be both. I absolutely loved it, and you're going to hear him talk about a bevy of topics, including O.J.'s resurgence, his time at Saturday Night Live, the film Dirty Work, how that gets confused for others. There's lots of different directions that we're going to go in there. Speaking of trying to get guests, this is what it's like now for me and Stanzik. And by the way, we got to get the ask out now, because Marty, December 23rd, Silence, he's going to want to do that everywhere. So I think we have a pretty good shot. Now that we got De Niro, I mean, once we get Marty's, hey, listen, Bob's been on the show. Can we get Marty? And we'll do it in December. But here's how it happens. You have to use every angle possible. I'm working the World Cup of Hockey. Chris Chelios is one of the guys that I'm working with. And I know he's tight with John Cusack. At one point, he even mentioned, he goes, oh, Cusack just texted me. Oh, Cutler's getting killed in Chicago. I'm like, all right, how do I broach this subject? You know, you work with him for a few days. You get to know him a little bit. Then you go, hey, okay, I do this podcast. So I just go ahead. Hey, man, I do this podcast. And if I, yeah, it's a good movie thing. Oh, okay, cool. I'm like, you know, I'd love to get John Cusack on. I don't know if you could help me with that. That's how you say it. You don't go, hey, what's his manager's number? Because that doesn't, who cares if I have John Cusack's manager's number? If Chris Chelios says, hey, do this for me. This guy's a good guy. That's the best chance you have. So could you help me out with that? Sure. Immediately. Gets his phone out. Texts him. Let's know what he says. Hour later, he writes back. He just laughs. He goes, ah, Cusack. And when he writes back, he was just like, because Chris had written, do you want to do this podcast? This guy to ESPN. He wrote, not really, unless there's money involved. So I said, well, write back and tell him De Niro did it, and De Niro did it for free. He goes, okay, I'll write that back. And then Chelios says, hey, oh, we got a little action. I go, really? What are you writing? He goes, what's his name? How many followers does he have? You know, what does he do? All right, good. So Chris writes back. He goes, how many followers? 75,000. Okay, good. We're getting about 30,000 per episode. Okay, good. All right. He writes it back. Hour later, Chelios looks at me and goes, ship has sailed. I go, what do you mean? What did he write back? He goes, he hasn't. That's the thing about Cusack. He goes, like, if he doesn't write back, he goes, now I'm not going to hear from him for like another 4 days. I go, are you kidding? He goes, I'm telling you right now, he's not interested. I was like, man, I go, does he have anything coming out? I go, that's the big thing. If these guys have something coming out, then they want to promote it. He goes, nothing. He's got nothing in the can. I go, all right, that's a bummer, but thanks anyways. He goes, don't worry about it. He's kind of become crazy anyways. I'm like, in what respect? He goes, hey, he's kind of like paranoid and stuff. He goes, like, the whole Snowden thing. I'm like, what do you mean the whole Snowden thing? He's like, he went and he visited Snowden. I'm like, the real Ed Snowden, John Cusack visited him in Russia? He's like, yeah, for like 3 days. I said, what did Cusack think of him? He goes, said he's a cool dude. I said, so what does this mean? He goes, well, now Cusack, like he's kind of paranoid. Like he's like, I think the government's watching him now. Like he's kind of, I'm telling you, he's a close friend of mine. He's a little crazy. Like he's a little worried now. Like he thinks his phone's wiretapped and emails. And I'm like, all right. Well, we didn't get John Cusack, but at least we got a story, and that story dovetails into the movie that I'm reviewing first, which is Oliver Stone's new film, Snowden. And it stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I think it's, first and foremost, it's Oliver Stone's best movie in 17 years. I mean, this is one of the great filmmakers of our time. Won Oscars for Platoon, which is one of my favorite war movies, Born on the 4th of July, which I think is still very powerful, Any Given Sunday, which I think is a great baseball movie, very stylish movie, and U-Turn. Nixon, I think, is an underrated biography. But he hasn't made a great film since Any Given Sunday, which was 1999. Like, he's made The Savages. He made Wall Street 2. Like, there's W, which is very goofy and cartoonish and like a caricature. So Stone actually hasn't made a really provocative Oliver Stone-type movie in a long time. So when Snowden comes along, you go, oh, this is perfect. Paranoid, government intrigue, you know, preying off of people's fears and insecurities. I'm like, that's the Oliver Stone that I'm looking for. And thankfully, I think in many ways, this movie hits the target. And the big reason why is he's got Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's a real chameleon as an actor. I think he has a lot of versatility, and he's shown that in his career. And I think as Snowden, he kind of inhabits him and makes him fully formed. You know, you've seen Snowden in interviews. I saw Citizen Four, the documentary, which won the Oscar, which is about him. And he comes across as a little bit stilted and monochromatic. And, you know, Gordon-Levitt, he does a good job with the voice first. He's got a very kind of monotone voice. But he gives him some depth. You know, he shows him with his girlfriend, played by Shailene Woodley. He shows that he's a guy who falls in love. And he's a guy who now, if you just hear the word Snowden, if you're on the left, people love him and say, like, you know, he came through because he's a whistleblower. And people on the right hate him and think he's a traitor. The first shock of the movie is that he's very much a right winger. When he meets Shailene Woodley early on when he's young, she's talking about the fact that he goes, oh, I'm a Republican. And she's like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, I'm like a huge conservative and I believe in less government involvement and blah, blah, blah. And she's like this young, typical liberal who challenges authority. So that was the first thing. I'm like, oh, he actually is like a very right-wing, hawkish guy. And he wants to be in the CIA and he wants to be part of the military, but, you know, he has health issues. He then meets an unfortunate cameo. Nicolas Cage pops up and I'm like, listen, I think Nicolas Cage did an okay job with it, but he's become such a parody. Like, he's such a hack with so many bad movies he's made that now you just can't take him seriously. Now I worry if I went back and saw good Nicolas Cage movies, like obviously Leaving Las Vegas or Red Rock West or even the film he did with Marty, Bringing Out the Dead, I think it'd be like, oh, God, Nicolas Cage just punched me in the face. I think that's how much his stock has dropped down. So he's actually okay in Snowden. It's a small role, but just the fact it's Nicolas Cage is unnerving. But anyway, Snowden then goes ahead and gets a job at the National Security Agency. So this is fascinating. Now he's working for NSA. And I don't know a lot about this world and the government intrigue, but it's interesting how Snowden kind of goes in there. And he's very honest and forthright about why he wants the job. He's like, I want to kind of know what the secrets are about the life. But this is the most important part of Snowden, the film, and basically what this whole environment is. Once you're in, you can't get out. Like, it's like the mafia. Like, no matter what happens, you have to stay silent. You can't do anything. Like, no matter what the protocol is that's being breached, whatever violations are occurring, once you're in, it's like a blood oath. And what happens is that he starts to see how this mountain of data is being assembled to track all forms of digital communication. And it is not just foreign governments and terrorist groups. It's not just a guy with a foreign-sounding name and you go, all right, let's start tracking him. But they go above and beyond that. And immediately they start taking liberties. So all of a sudden the guy's an ethnic-sounding name. Let's see what his daughter's up to. Oh, let's go into her Facebook page. Okay, let's make her miserable. Like, they are literally toying with people's lives. And Snowden sees this and he's appalled. He's like, hang on a second. You guys aren't just targeting terrorists. You're just targeting average Americans who are from foreign countries like Syria or, you know, the Middle Eastern countries that you go, maybe this guy's a terrorist. But you actually have no information. And you're blatantly looking at his emails and his daughter's Facebook page. Like, this isn't right. This isn't what you should be doing. And they're like, whatever. We're going to do whatever we can. What are you talking about? This is Homeland Security. We do whatever we want. There are no rules. We make up the rules. We're the ones who are the authorities here. And Snowden starts – the wheels start to turn. Like, I don't know if this is right necessarily. And the moment that he really gets unnerved by is that they start spying on this girl, and they're doing it through the camera, like her webcam. So later on, he goes home. He's with Shailene Woodley, his girlfriend, and he puts a piece of tape over the computer. And she's like, what are you doing? He's like, it's just whatever, security measures. She's like, what do you mean? And she's like, what, are the Russians watching me? He's like, yeah, it's just like, you know, like, not the Russians, but, you know, I can't get into it. She goes, what, American CIA, National Security Agency is watching me at all times? He's like, yeah, like, they're watching all of us, like, yeah. And she's like, what do you mean? Because he's horrified. Like, later on, they're like making love. And he's like, no, these guys are looking at my girlfriend, like in her bikini and bra. And they're just sitting there cracking jokes and having beers. Like, it sounds so outlandish. But once you see how it's created, you go, yeah, of course these guys know what's going on. And so much so that, like, now it makes – not that it makes me paranoid, but it does call to reality that every single thing you say and do is being watched. And it's not necessarily that the room is being bugged. But if you send an email and you say something critical about our government or you make some sort of flippant comment, they don't view it as flippant. They put you on a watch list. Like, all right, let's start tracking Dan Stanzik's email. He seems to be rather anti-authoritarian, has some issues with our government, rather fierce libertarian. Okay, add him to the list. We got plenty of guys here to track. And that's the breaking point. Like, it just keeps building and building for Snowden. And Oliver Stone does an excellent job of creating that tension and that drama of how this guy who is so rigid and so dedicated to the government eventually starts to turn. And when do you have that crisis moment? When do you have that crisis of conscience that you go, hang on a second, this isn't right. And I'm going to be a whistleblower. And I'm going to tell these guys. So eventually, you know, for those that don't know the fact-based tale, he ends up, you know, spilling the beans, ends up going to Russia, which is where he now lives. He'd love to come home. Joseph Gordon-Levitt met with them for research. And he goes, listen, I want to come home. But if he comes home, he's going to be tried and persecuted, maybe thrown in jail. And he believes that he should be pardoned. And it's very polarizing. Either you think because Snowden leaked classified information, if you believe that because he went against what he signed up for, that he is therefore a traitor by letting loose the fact that the government and what they're doing is wrong, then you feel like he's a fugitive from the law. Those that think he's a hero, is the fact that he saw something that was incorrect that was going on, protocol that was absolutely incorrect and unconstitutional, and said, I need to call attention to this, and the best way I can call attention to it is by leaking it to the media and making it a major news story. Then you think he's a hero. You go, this guy had some serious guts to now risk his life and now living overseas and to say, no, this isn't right. So the film definitely caters towards that latter sentiment. Stone clearly thinks that he's heroic in what he did and that you need more whistleblowers like this. Definitely reminded me of the film The Insider, you know, in that you have people here under duress, making challenging choices, facing stress, facing adversity and trying to overcome it. So the film's a little bit heavy-handed at times, probably could have been a little bit riskier. You know, I think some like Stone's great films, like Natural Born Killers is a movie I love. Stylistically, he took so many chances with that, with the color correction and the jump cuts and the crazy music and things out of sequence. Snowden does not do that. Like, he, in terms of cinematically, Stone shoots it very close to the vest. He's not using any of those tricks of the trade, so to speak, to tell a rather straightforward story. But I definitely recommend it. Like I said, for Stone, it's a good comeback. I give it 3 Maple Leafs. So Snowden is the film currently now in theaters. Before we get to Norm Macdonald, since Danzig is always politically savvy, your thoughts on Snowden? I'm assuming you haven't seen the film. What do you think of the guy?
I'm kind of on the fence. I mean, I don't really have a side, but the whole part where you're talking about, you can view him either way. Like, he clearly signed up for something and broke the rules. It reminded me of a Douglas MacArthur quote, "You are remembered for the rules that you break."
Yeah, and from that perspective, like, it was gutsy what he did, because it's like, not to be too moralistic, but this isn't right. I need to call attention to this no matter what the consequences are. And I guess the other side would say, well, then you go to your superiors and there's a line of command and you do this and you say, but yeah, but they're not going to listen. Once I start chirping, once they think I'm insubordinate, then I'm done. They'll fire me. They'll get rid of me.
Yeah, it's real easy to cast off what he did, but it's not easy to do what he did.
That is profound. Well done by Stanzik. Coming up, we're going to review a movie called Audrey and Daisy, which is a documentary about teen sexual assault. It's an excellent documentary. We'll be talking to the filmmakers as well. Also, Green Room with Patrick Stewart and the late Anton Yelchin, real tragic story that he's now passed away. And also the family movie Storks, now in theaters with my guy Andy Samberg. Now, if Andy Samberg's in it after Popstar, I have to go support him, watch everything that he does. But first, here is the great Norm Macdonald. Thanks so much for listening to Cinephile as we continue. I'm Adnan Virk, joined by special guest Norm Macdonald.
Wait, why is Jeff Goldblum on?
Well, yeah, sometimes we have all these TVs up here in the studio. There's maybe a story about Goldblum going on. He's looking kind of creepy there, isn't he?
Yeah, usually you can tell by the picture.
That something's happened to him.
Because he's in a bathroom. There's a picture of him in a bathroom.
Yeah, I think he must be selling something, right? Because it's a Goldblum. Yeah, 8x8. For those listening.
Look at his muscles.
It's a Goldblum 8x10. There's pictures of him. Maybe he's coming to Connecticut.
He told me a story, but I guess I'm not at liberty really to.
That's okay.
I'll tell you off pod.
Please do. Two Canadians here.
Yeah, that's right.
You're the second Canadian to be on the podcast. Will Arnett was the first.
Will Arnett.
Do you know Will Arnett?
Where is he from?
He's from Toronto.
Okay.
And he's right in the city. You were born in Quebec City, but you grew up in Ontario?
Yeah, you know, Quebec City is all French. And we were English. So, you know, the English hate the French, and the French hate the English.
Right, the Québécois.
So, I was born in with the Québécois around, and my dad, you could go to school, you could either learn French or Latin. So my dad would not let me learn French because he was so afraid that I would, you know, take up with a French girl or something like that. So I learned Latin, and that doesn't help you that much. In Quebec City, where there's a lot of French and no ancient Romans.
But I will say this. Montreal is more bilingual. Like, Quebec City is very much French.
No, Montreal is English.
In Montreal, if you go there, you speak English, you feel fine. People get terrified. They go, oh, my God, I don't know the language. I don't understand.
Oh, no. Montreal is very cosmopolite.
The reason I mention this is last week you met Donald Trump. Tonight Show.
I sort of met him.
Well, how big are his hands?
I didn't really shake his hand.
Okay,
this is what happened. I have met him before, and he does have gigantic hands. It's like shaking the hand of a Holstein cow. No, but this is what happened. This is the true thing that happened. There's like about 4 minutes difference because I had to follow him, you know. So he leaves in the hall, and I'm in the hall, and I'm going to go on, right? I'm the second guest. First time ever I'm in the second guest. Thanks to Trump. So I see Donald Trump. So I say, Donald, can I get a picture? So he turns to me And he goes, hey, points at me, you know. He goes, big smile. He goes, just give me 1 minute and we'll take a picture. So I go, thanks. Then he turns around. He has a Secret Service. Mm-hmm. And he walks down the hall and gets in an elevator.
He just Donald said, Trump completely stiffed you.
Yeah, he said in a minute, and then he left the building.
The oldest trick in the book. Give me 1 second. Yeah, I'll be right back.
Exactly.
Just standing there at a ball game. Can you sign my ball?
Oh, my God.
Well, the reason I mentioned this,
I remember Euchre. I was with Euchre in a booth, you know, in Arizona. It was a spring training. And so all the fans were trying to reach up, you know, to hand him balls to sign, you know. Mm-hmm. So Euchre would sign a ball, and then he'd hand it to me. He goes, here, f***ing sign it. So I go, no, I don't want to sign it. Like, they don't want me to sign. He goes, sign it, man. So I go, all right. So I'd sign the ball, and then the guy would get it. Go, oh. Like, I completely devalued what value Euchre had just put on the baseball.
That's not true. It's more value with that.
Probably worth less than an actual baseball at that point.
I want to get your thought. This is why I'm concerned about
the election. I mean, a store-bought baseball.
Because as Canadians, you know, we're not allowed to vote in this country.
We can't vote.
And people keep saying, no, you have to. Barry Melrose is like, no, you have to apply for U.S. citizenship so you can vote. This is the most important election of our time. And I looked up the rule. I don't know if you ever went this far, but in order to apply for U.S. citizenship, there's a caveat there, Norm, that says you must renounce all loyalty to any other country. And I said, hang on a second. Like, I'm proud to be in America, but I'm a proud Canadian. You can't be a dual citizen? No, it's you can, but you have to renounce loyalty to Canada.
Oh, I see.
I don't want to renounce loyalty.
Yeah.
Is that your reasoning as well, that you've never...
No, my reasoning is that the test is way too hard. You know what I mean?
How many Supreme Court justices
are there? How many stripes on the flag? I don't know. Like, our flag has a leaf. Like, here a flag is so important. Like, you can't burn it. Oh, you can't burn the flag.
You have
flag.
To stand for it.
Yeah, Canada, it gets cold, you burn the flag. I mean, there's a leaf on it. It almost invites incineration, you know.
Especially, like, the prairie provinces. They don't really, in Saskatchewan. Go ahead. OJ.
The Saskatchewan Rough Riders and the Ottawa Rough Riders.
Eight teams in the CFL.
Eight teams.
And both had the same nickname for years.
Two of them.
The first question Americans would always ask me.
Yeah.
They ask about
But there's
Don
no Cherry. Answer to it.
No, there is no answer. It's just a really good name, though. I don't think
there's a fantastic name. Yeah. It's also an American name because, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. So I don't know how it came to Canada, but no one has the answer to the question.
Your brother's a journalist at CBC, isn't he?
Yeah.
You should ask him.
Yeah, he should do it like a documentary and try to figure it out because no one has the answer. I've seriously asked people. They're like, ha. They laugh, and I go, no, but seriously, it's funny. Because, you know, you used to listen to football games on the radio, mm-hmm. and it would be very confusing because, you know, they'd be going, the Rough Riders have it at the 5-yard line, bad news for the Rough Riders. If the Rough Riders get it here, the Rough Riders are in big trouble. You know, you go, what's going on?
So SNL Weekend Update, you were tremendous. And so much of it was not only your delivery, but also your fearlessness. And it's one of the greatest jokes ever. I encourage everybody to go look it up. Norm was talking about Lisa Marie Presley and Michael Jackson, and he said they've split up, citing irreconcilable differences. She's more of a stay-at-home mom. He's more of a homosexual pedophile.
Oh, that's a terrible thing to say.
You were fearless. Like, did you have any?
I remember Lauren saying, you know, you better, you know, if you, you don't want to be sued by Michael Jackson. And I go, no. But secretly I did. I was like, oh, my God, that'd be the coolest thing ever. I'd be like, and now Michael Jackson versus Norm. I'd be like, oh, my God, this is, I mean, cool. I mean, how could that not be good for your career?
But Don Olmeyer, because he was buddy.
Don Olmeyer was the, for the folks at home.
Right.
Was the executive in charge of entertainment for the entire network of NBC.
And only because you were making scathing, hysterical jokes at O.J. Simpson's expense, who's now back in the news because the show was a huge hit.
He's back in the news.
Well, the show, I should say, his name is back in the news. Like the Emmys, Sarah Paulson won, the show won.
What show? Oh,
People versus O.J. Simpson.
Right.
And then the O.J. documentary, 30 for 30, which is on ESPN. And I think you should get more praise for the fact you were attacking him, rightfully so. And just because Olmeyer was buddies with him, was like, hey, you can't touch O.J. It's like, well, what do you mean? Like, everyone's...
Yeah, why wasn't I in that movie?
Oh, the 30 for 30, that's true, actually.
Or the 30 for 30, yeah, they could have put that on. Just, well, or the drama. You know what I mean?
Yeah, People versus.
They could have had like Jay Moore going, "Hey, yeah. What's going on?"
Could have had
that hilarious impression.
David Letterman needed a Bette Midler moment that final week, and he got it from you.
That's what I was thinking.
Because, and it was so great. I watched it again.
Not that I meant to cry.
No.
I didn't mean that, but I wanted to do one of his jokes. That was my idea.
It was awesome. It was amazing what you did. You went on, your stand-up, it was the final week of Dave's show, and you said, growing up in, I love this, by the way, you said, growing up in Toronto, Canada. Nobody ever says Toronto, Ontario.
Yes.
I like to make it very plain.
I do.
Toronto, Canada.
I do, yeah.
And you said, there's a joke that Dave used to tell. You tell it. You know the joke.
It was on a show called 90 Minutes Live, hosted by Peter Zosky. And the guests were Ricky Jay and David Letterman. And I was in the audience, the young teenager. And his joke was, I was driving down the street the other day, and in front of me was a garbage truck. And on the back of the garbage truck was a tiny sign that said, "Please do not follow too closely. One of life's simple pleasures, ruined by a meddling bureaucracy, ladies and gentlemen." Remember the old days when Dad used to pile the kids into the station wagon and we'd go out and follow a garbage truck?
You then turned to Dave and you said, "We know Mr. Letterman does not like the mawkish or the sentimental, but if something is true, then it is not that. And Dave, I love you."
Yes, I didn't mean to say those exact words. I certainly didn't mean to say I love you. But, I just thought at that moment after the joke I should say something, because everybody was being so cool about it before that. And like you say, there was no Bette Midler moment. There was no one saying, "We'll miss you," or anything like that. Everybody was just trying to be cool, you know?
Yeah.
And he was a very important person to me, David Letterman.
Because he defended you when Omar.
Well, no, but more than that, I think he changed the entire culture. He changed how people speak, you know? Almost like ESPN changed the way that people speak about sports. And, maybe David Letterman is responsible for ESPN.
No, there's no doubt. He was a huge influence. Dave used to come here because he's such an auto racing nut. He'd come here and watch the F1 races and stuff.
Oh,
and
is that right?
They would let him in the back, and he would just go and set up.
Oh, you mean because there were
they didn't have that capability, like in the early 90s.
Capability, right.
A Formula 1
race
or something. He's like, "Oh, I'll just go to ESPN." Wow. And come in here. I'm like, "Oh, there's Dave." Just
that's what I would do for football back when I – because, of course, there was no dish or anything like that. And in New York – all you could watch was a Jets game in the morning and a Giants game in the afternoon, and they both sucked. They were horrible.
Right.
And there were all these great games going on, so I would go to NBC and watch the feed. There'd be every game.
Right.
And then I'd pretend to be an announcer. I'd turn off the – I still do that when my son lets me. He hates when I do that. But I switch, like on DirecTV, and I go, "Now let's go," you know.
Right, well, you got Red Zone now. You can just watch one channel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I don't do. I do my own Red Zone.
Oh, so you like to do it. The book is called "Based on a True Story."
What book is that?
This is your book.
Oh yes, my book. I wrote
can't
a book.
Wait to read this.
"Based on a True Story," a memoir by Norm Macdonald.
It's going to be a huge hit. I can't
wait.
Right, Jennifer's here. Yeah, there's stories about Olmeyer. There's stories.
Yes.
We have a story. A buddy here, Daniel. Him and his wife wanted to watch "Dirty Work" together, so he DVR'd it. And they put it on, and it was not the film "Dirty Work" that you made.
Oh, there's another one, yeah.
It was a
documentary?
No, it was an HBO film's softcore, I think, is the category.
Oh, it was a porn. You know, one time in my hotel room, before the computer and everything,
right.
The only time I'd ever see pornography was in a hotel. And sometimes they'd have, like, the weirdest one, they have like soft core pornography. You know what I mean? And this actually happened. I was looking around and there was Pulp Fiction was on.
Oh, I love Pulp Fiction, yeah.
And it wasn't, it was Pump Friction.
No, Pulp Friction, maybe.
Yeah.
Pump Friction. That's like if you want to watch Saving Private Ryan, you'd get Saving Ryan's Privates.
Not as good a film at all. Way less. It's just basically a futon and a lady.
Does it have Spielberg's directorial mastery?
Yeah,
like,
no, nothing.
First
no.
10 minutes.
No sweeping. No sweeping crane shots.
Right.
Just a lot of a lot of close ups of what looks like it should be on a medical channel of some sort.
Based on a true story, a memoir by Norm.
Based on a true story.
Go out and check it out.
Memoir by Norm Macdonald.
I thank you so much for coming, Norm. I know you're making a comeback.
Are we done?
Well, do you want to keep going?
They told me it was an hour.
Oh, is it? Okay, we'll keep going. Now he's giving me the wave here.
We're done.
I would keep going.
Good Lord, I had no idea. Well, I think we should have something to wrap it up.
Sure. Well, tell me a great anecdote from the book that's something that can really sell.
I'm trying to think of a sports joke.
Well, you've made a few.
Well, I'll tell you this. You want to know why?
Best
this,
OJ
this
joke.
This is not a joke. This is not a joke.
Okay, fair.
But I used to be a very heavy sports gambler.
Well, now you're prognosticating on the Levitard show.
I am prognosticating on the Levitard show. Yes, I'm. What am I? 7-3 for the year.
That's awesome, man.
That make money. That pay the juice well, you know. And 7-3. Now listen to this. Professional football is the hardest sport to prognosticate. Baseball's the easiest. Now,
baseball's the easiest because the starting pitcher, you just go.
No, baseball's the easiest because baseball is a game of streaks.
Okay, gotcha.
You think of Kirk Gibson hitting that home run, right?
Mm-hmm.
Against the much better team.
Oakland A's, yep.
What game did he hit that home run in?
He hit it in game one.
Game one. He won the series in game one.
That's true.
So it shows you the power of the streak.
Right.
The Boston Red Sox, down 3.
The Yankees, yep.
They win 4 in a row. And then what happens?
And they win the World Series.
They win another 4 in a row, right? Because of the streak, the power of the streak.
Yeah.
So you hit a team when it's on a good streak or a bad streak, and you just stay on them.
All right.
Stay on them. The reason professional football is so hard to bet is because the ball ain't round. Every other sport, almost, the ball is round. A round golf ball in a round hole. You throw a round basketball into a round hoop. But a football is this odd shape. So if there's a fumble, that's anywhere, man.
Right.
And then there's this odd thing that's certainly against the rules. 30 guys jump on the football. Now, someone has that football at the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's being touched, so that should be his possession.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he's being punched in the testicles, you know, and his eyes are being gouged out, and someone grabs the football, someone else grabs the football, and finally they tear off the guy, and they go, oh, this, look, the big giant guy has the football. What a coincidence.
So, there you have it. That's why football is so tough.
So don't bet football because the ball ain't round.
Thanks so much, Norm. I appreciate it.
All right. This was beautiful, Adnan. Love you.
Oh, I love you too, Norm. Rare that a guest nails my name, by the way. Most of the time, they just, hey, buddy, how are you? Hey, Adnan, he learned it.
Can we please point out to the audience how important that is to you? Yeah, I believe you once told me that as a Sports Center anchor, you would view analysts and guests based solely on the fact about whether or not they name-checked you, as you would say. So if you had Sal Palantonio on, for example, and you said, hey, Sal, and he didn't say, hello, Adnan, you'd be like, eh, terrible interview.
No,
if he said, hey, Adnan, great.
You're making me sound way too petty here. There's no doubt it's important to me. I think, listen, in this business, we're trying to personalize things. You should get to know a guy a little bit. For Norm, that's going above and beyond. For my coworkers, we're supposed to be collegial on the air. They should know my name because I'm saying their name. Joining us now is Sal. Pedro, what's the latest? Well, Adnan, it sounds like we're all one big happy family. Norm doesn't need to say my name, but I appreciate that he did. That shows he's a good dude. How do you think that interview is going to be received by the average person?
Strongly. One way or the other. Either it was a miserable 15 minutes or they loved it. One way or another, we got porn referenced on Cinephile 2 weeks in a row. Last week, Terry Crews. This week, Norm. That's a hot streak.
All right, let's review a couple more movies, and then we're going to do some streaming suggestions. First off, a film that's very different. It's called Audrey and Daisy. And this is a documentary about two teenage girls who are sexually assaulted. And different sides of America. One is in Saratoga, and one is in the Midwest. And basically, it's a story that I'm sure happens all the time. You know, teenagers are going to drink, and they're going to do it in high school. And unfortunately, what happens here is rather tragic. You know, one of the girls, it's Audrey and Daisy are the two characters. And one of them, Audrey, is in Saratoga, where she's in high school and having a good time at a party, and everything seems okay. She's 15 years old, and unfortunately, she has a little bit too much to drink. And what happens is a bunch of her so-called friends end up taking her clothes off and then writing all over it with like a marker. So they're putting like, you know, lewd jokes on different parts of her body. And then it's later revealed that, you know, one of them actually violates her as well. When you're watching the film, you're just, you know, obviously you're taken aback by the behavior while at the same time recognizing that it happens. Like it goes from that, you know, boys will be boys, girls will be girls. Everyone just has a drink, 15 years old. So one thing leads to another, too. okay, wow, that's awkward, to, oh, my goodness. And in the case of Audrey Pott of Saratoga High School in Saratoga, California, she has too much to drink. Guys write all over her, make jokes. A couple violate her in a very inappropriate manner. She wakes up the next morning, doesn't remember what happened. And then what's different about this story in this documentary is the use that social media plays. And the way that she ends up being affected by this is not by what she hears from students the next day she's at school, but it's abuse of cyberbullying. And it's all the comments that she gets on her Facebook page. So the film very smartly tracks, you know, in real time. So it's like the incident happens and then she starts writing to her friends like, what happened? And like, you know, you guys are supposed to be my friends. Like, oh, we were just being funny. We're just having a good time. And I said, but wait, I don't remember what happened. Like, I got marker all over myself with like all these gross jokes and stuff. And like, this isn't funny. And it's just such overwhelming shame she feels and embarrassment. And, you know, she goes to school one day. Her mom picks her up. Her mom says, yep, she went to her room, went to take a shower. And then like 10 minutes later, her mom goes in there and she's hanging. You know, like she killed herself. And you're stunned watching the film because you go, oh, my goodness. Like, I get that this happens. I get that it would be incredibly painful and shameful and humiliating. But you don't have to kill yourself. Like, you can deal with this somehow. But then you watch it and you go, well, how would you deal with it? Like, if you're a 15-year-old girl and everyone's laughing at you and everywhere you go, you feel like everyone's judging you and your self-esteem is already low to begin with and you feel like you had friends, but now they took advantage of you. And it's awfully sad seeing just how the parents are affected by it because now they want justice. Now, here's the second part of this. One is these incidents happen. Two, sexual assault is notoriously difficult to convict in this country. And the guys that are then called in to talk about it say, yeah, okay, we're just having a little bit of fun. Okay, we had a few drinks, whatever. But A, everyone's going to collude together. You know, it's tough to really get to the truth. And B, like just to get a conviction the way the law is set up, it's incredibly difficult. So Audrey's accusers don't end up getting much. I think it's maybe, I don't even want, like maybe a month in jail. Like it's incredibly light sentence. I don't even know if it's that. Maybe it's like a probationary sentence or like a halfway house. It's awful. The other story is about Daisy Coleman, who's 14 years old, and her 13-year-old friend Paige. They're in Maryville, Missouri. And same issue here. A few drinks at a party. Get drunk. One of the guys takes advantage of her. The story, the way it's told by the brother is heartbreaking. He says that he woke up and he saw Daisy outside and her hair was frozen to the ice outside on the lawn. And like literally just to lift her head up, like he had to like chop the ice off and like she was just blue and frozen. And one of the accused says that what happened was that, okay, we had a few drinks. One of the guys took it a little bit too far. Then we're like, all right, we got to clean this up. And then they just dropped her off outside. Like, just the inhumanity, the fact that you're that cold and miserable, you don't have a heart, that you just leave a 15-year-old girl outside frozen. You're like, no, let's just get out of here. Like, there's the body. Okay, we didn't kill her. Just figure it out. And the brother is obviously incensed, and he wants to exact justice. And the parents are trying to get justice. But again, it's the same thing. It's all the cyberbullying. It's all the Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and you're getting made fun of. And like, how do you react by this? And you go through the court documents and the police investigations. And again, slap on the wrist. You can't really get much with these guys. 3 months, whatever it is. And the post-assault treatment of sexual assault victims, the way that they go back and live through it. It's a harrowing piece of work, but I think it's an important documentary to see. It's called Audrey and Daisy. It's directed by Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck. And it's currently on Netflix. It just started being available streaming as of September 23rd. It was released at Sundance earlier this year, but I definitely recommend people to check out the film, 3.5 Maple Leafs. The basics of it I've kind of outlined, but trust me, when you actually see the story and see how it unfolds and the power of it, it really is quite moving. And it's a real tragedy that Audrey is no longer with us. And even though Daisy is alive, as the documentary shows, she really has changed. She went from this really kind of sweet, innocent, bucolic lifestyle to now she's very kind of dark and morose and, you know, dyed her hair and tattoos, and she's very kind of has a lot of dark thoughts and demons. And you just go, you know, one person's dead, one person's alive, but her life is irreparably changed because of this incident. So it's a rather sad story. It's a rather sobering documentary, but I do encourage it. Audrey and Daisy, I give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. The next one I want to touch on is called Green Room. This is currently out on DVD and Netflix, and it's a real disappointment. It got excellent reviews, which is why I wanted to see it. I said, well, okay, it's just a thriller. And Patrick Stewart's in it. Patrick Stewart plays the bad guy. So originally I'm like, okay, I'm in for that. And it's a couple of members of a punk rock band. Anton Yelchin, the late actor who passed away, and Aaliyah Shavkat, who you'll remember from Arrested Development. Happy to see her working again. I'm like, hey, everybody else from that show has incredible roles. Maybe. Hey, she's back. All right. Green Room. Here we go. So basically they're part of a punk rock group, but they're in this remote Oregon roadhouse playing a set, and they end up witnessing a murder, and now it becomes a fight for survival. So it becomes a real horror film. It's written and directed by Jeremy Saulnier. And I guess the reason why people liked it was because its grittiness or the fact that it was really kind of put you in that scene. But I got to be honest with you. I thought it was one concept and that's it, which is members of a punk rock band see a murder. Now they're stuck in a room. It's called Green Room. They're being terrorized. That's it. To me, it was a rather rote thriller and nothing all that substantial. I guess the aspect that is different is that they're being terrorized by a bunch of neo-Nazi skinheads. And again, this is the thing. I'm like, oh, it's Patrick Stewart. All right, Captain Picard here getting down and dirty. But it's a small role for him. He's only in maybe 20 minutes. And I would think an actor like that, like if he's going to play the villain, either he's going to be like so cold and menacing or he's really ramping it up and he's just like wildly over the top. Instead, he's neither. He's just kind of there and kind of blah. And I'm surprised it got good reviews, to be honest with you. On Rotten Tomatoes, people really like it, but I was disappointed. I'm giving Green Room 1.5 Maple Leafs. As far as a good shock thriller goes, it was not shocking or thrilling to me. Last one, I just want to quickly mention Storks because Andy Samberg's in it. So like I said earlier, I have to watch everything he does. Good movie with the kids. I went and saw it. I give it 3 Maple Leafs. Again, we still haven't had a great kids film so far this year, but it's a sweet story about how babies are delivered and Samberg plays one of the storks, and Kelsey Grammer, who has a great voice, great gift for voice acting, he's like the evil, menacing stork. But without giving away too much of the story, it's just really colorful animation, kind of a hyperkinetic plot, which is rare to say for a kid's movie. Like, Inside Out's one of those movies that kind of has a frenzied plot, but this one also, you know, the storks being rescued, now they're catching babies, now they're fleeing, now they're all over the place. It's actually quite herky-jerky, but it actually worked with the color. Remind me a little bit of the film Happy Feet in that it had a lot of good colorful animation, but kind of a wild plot at times. So listen, good kids movie, good voice work, really sweet ending. If you like babies, they're all in. 3 stars, 3 Maple Leafs. I'm sorry for Storks. Continuing my love here for Andy Samberg.
Streaming suggestions.
A few great ones here. Grizzly Man is currently on Netflix, the Werner Herzog documentary. It's insane. It basically, Werner Herzog, if you don't know his filmography, does creepy and bizarre and oddball about as good as it gets. And Grizzly Man fits in that mold. Basically, if you like grizzly bears and the nature and the wild and wonder about what that world is like and want a documentary that puts you in the heart of it, go watch Grizzly Man. Patton, the great George C. Scott film, war film. Of course, he won the Best Actor for it. I don't think it holds up great. It's 1970, the movie came out, and you know now you've seen war sequences that are better, like Saving Private Ryan and Platoon and Glory. But the first 10 minutes of Patton, awesome. It's just him standing in front of an American flag giving the speech. It's one of the great openings in American cinema. Go back. If right now, go on Netflix, watch the first 10 minutes of Patton just to get a sense of that awesome George C. Scott speech. Just about patriotism, and it's not necessarily that you agree with the speech because he comes across like a big blowhard, but I love the fact that that's exactly what George Patton would sound like, look like in terms of total immersion. George C. Scott gets in it right away, and it's a powerful way to start a movie, just right to the camera. Here we go. Also, Quiz Show. We've talked a lot about John Turturro, his renaissance with the film The Night Of. He's also great in that Robert Redford film, 1994. As those who have listened know my disdain for Forrest Gump and the fact it beat out Shawshank Redemption and Pulp Fiction for Best Picture. Also, what came out in 1994, Lion King, which is a great animated movie, and Quiz Show, which is a fantastic film. It's about a quiz show, obviously, makes sense with that title. And Ray Fiennes is one of the contestants in the show who gets answers fed to him through his ear. And Herbie Stemple is Turturro, who does not do that. He actually plays the game the right way because he's this nerdy, geeky Jewish guy with bad teeth, bad hair, big glasses. Like, you know what? He's not that photogenic. Fiennes is good looking, handsome. He's going to be the star of the show, which is called 21. And Rob Morrow plays the journalist. Terrible Boston accent by Rob Morrow, but he's okay in the movie. Hasn't done much since Northern Exposure. That was at the height of, hey, Rob Morrow, we got to get him in this. And he plays the guy who uncovers a story. A wonderful scene between Ray Fiennes and his dad in the movie, which is really powerful towards the end where he just, you know, he says, listen, you're not just shaming yourself, you're shaming me because his dad's this very erudite professor. Go ahead, Stanza.
Wasn't that based on some sort of scandal with $64,000 question?
Yeah. And that's where they use that as kind of a jumping off point. And it goes, again, it asks questions about ethics and morality and doing the right thing, but you kind of see it from all sides. It's a film like that you see. You understand why a guy like Ray Fiennes would say, but it's too attractive to keep knowing all the answers and being the smart guy, and I can't expose this cover-up. And Robert Redford directed it. Really good film. It's currently on Netflix. Also, just a few movies here on Amazon Prime, Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore documentary, one of his best, definitely ahead of the curve in terms of talking about gun violence and gun control. So it must be interesting, I think, considering all the events happening right now in our country, to go back and watch Bowling for Columbine. The Last Waltz, which I'll talk about another time, Scorsese documentary. It's about the band. It's really good, so go see it. I'll tell a Scorsese story about it another time, but really well done, Robbie Robertson. It was influential in terms of concert films because he actually, the directing and the shot composition, he did to the music. So he literally knew the set list, and for each lyric, he had a specific camera move. So when you're watching the film, it's not like just one floating camera and Coldplay's playing. Like, on every single shot, he knows to go right to a close-up to a guitar, right to the drums, right to Robbie Robertson, because he's going to do this on this lyric. So it's really immaculate, the way that Scorsese directs it. The Last Waltz, really good documentary. And Misery, one of the great horror movies of the last 20 years. You know about hobbling, don't you? Kathy Bates won Best Actress for the role back in 1990. James Caan, the scenery, just grabs a typewriter and throws it on her head. A little kitschy, I think, maybe in retrospect, but Rob Reiner directed a really good horror movie. Richard Farnsworth in the movie as well. Misery, way back from 1990. It's currently streaming, and it's available on Amazon Prime.
A Scorsese story.
Once again, check out the book, Martin Scorsese, retrospective by John Sean, I think, S-H-O-N-E. Maybe it's John Schoen. Either way, it's fantastic. So make sure you check it out. One of the stories that was reminded of this, because we've talked so far about all the major ones, Mean Streets, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, is Last Temptation of Christ. And a fun game I found with people who are real cineasts and movie geeks, I say, okay, who is Scorsese's fifth best film? Because most would argue that it's Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, Mean Streets is the four. And for five, you got some that go, oh, I love Wolf of Wall Street. Some say I love The Departed. Some say Gangs of New York. Age of Innocence is one out of the box. Real great costume drama he did. King of Comedy would probably be mine because I think it's so funny and so underrated. But one that people mention is Last Temptation of Christ. And I'll lean on Stanzik here, who was raised Catholic. Lapsed Catholic now? Is that fair to say? Just not going to church, but...
Yeah, raised Catholic. I think most people, general progression of life here.
Yeah. But obviously familiar with all the dogma and the disciples. So the controversy around the film was this. Scorsese reads the book. I don't know if you read the book by Nikos Kazantzakis.
I thought you meant the Bible.
Not the Bible. Last Temptation of Christ by Nikos Kazantzakis. He gets the book by Barbara Hershey back when he was making Boxcar Bertha. It took him 6 years to read the book. But you know this, having gone to church and being raised in Catholicism. He said what he found it difficult, and Marty was raised to be an altar boy. Like, he was going to be a guy who really devoted himself towards his faith, but ended up becoming the patron saint of modern cinema. He said the problem was this. I found that the way that Jesus was described, he was just so holy and immaculate, and I couldn't understand it. Whereas when I read Last Temptation, I'm like, oh, this is someone I can understand. It was a Jesus who was afflicted by self-doubt and guilt and frustration and really had to kind of torture himself and torment himself to get these sermons out of him and to deal with all these challenges and overcome what was around him. So that's why I wanted to make the film. Couldn't get it made, tried to get financing. They go, nobody wants to see this film. And all the right-wing people are not going to see this. They're furious with him saying, listen, we don't want to see Jesus depicted as an ordinary human being. Like, no, this is the Son of God, if you believe in Trinity, etc. So he's going to all these studios and they're going, listen, Marty, we love you. This is early 80s. So he's made Raging Bull. He's made his masterpiece. He's made Taxi Driver. He's made Mean Streets. But they're going, we're not giving you money to make this. It's not worth the riots and the controversy. And the fact that United Artists, like, they're just going to boycott the film. They're not going to put it in the movie. So he's talking to Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner. They go, okay, listen, you can make something else. Because he talked to Barry Diller and he goes, listen, I can get you maybe like $4 million. But Marty's like, I can't make a movie for $4 million. Last Temptation of Christ, are you kidding? I got to go to Morocco and make it look like Bethlehem and all the rest of it. And how am I going to build Damascus in modern day world? And they go, okay, here's a better idea. We'll give you something else just to keep working. So it was Katzenberg and Eisner recommended Beverly Hills Cop. And he goes, what's that? And he goes, it's a fish out of water tale, but a cop in L.A. And Scorsese's response was, what's a fish out of water? Just no concept of these things. Like, could you imagine Beverly Hills Cop, Axel Foley, directed by Martin Scorsese? They also offered him Witness. And he goes, what's that about? And they go, it's about these Amish people in Pennsylvania. And Marty goes, I know nothing about Amish. I don't know. Harrison Ford, okay, great. Ended up being a really good movie. Peter Weir directed it. I think it was up for Best Picture. But Marty goes, I can't. Again, I have to make movies I can relate to. I don't know anything but Amish people in Pennsylvania. No. Long story short, he made After Hours, which we'll talk about another time. But a few years later, he gets the money for Last Temptation of Christ. And I got to be honest with you. Maybe if I knew, maybe if I'd read the Bible and been really in depth, I would understand more of it. But at times, the movie's baffling. Like, you have no idea, I think, unless you really understand Scripture, what exactly is happening. There's a few sequences that still stand out, one of which is when Jesus, who's played by Willem Dafoe, he gets spooked, you know, by the Holy Ghost. He's in the middle of the desert, and he has these visions and stuff. And that's where I could appreciate what Marty was going for, this idea of the supernatural. But really, his guy, his version of Jesus is meant to be like someone that you could know and feel, and it's very tangible. And one of the criticisms of the film is Keitel, who plays Judas. Like he's playing Keitel, like he's Mean Streets. Like he's not talking like Judas, you'd think, like with an accent. Like he sounds like he's from Brooklyn, and it's like a Brooklyn guy playing Judas. And you're like, what? I get that Marty's going for modern day style, but this is something that happened 2,000 years ago. So I didn't think Keitel's got like red hair in the movie. It's all dyed, curly. I didn't think he was strong. Even the film tries to depict Judas not as bad as Christian theology does. So that was another issue. Huge controversy when it comes out. A bunch of theaters boycott it. He did get the film made. He was nominated for Best Director. I think the film community just goes, oh, my God, I can't believe Marty actually got this movie made. Let's reward him. So he actually was nominated, even though the film didn't make much money. It was a box office dud. Gene Siskel called it the best picture of 1988. He loves it. But the best part of the movie, the best reason to watch it is the last 15 minutes, because the title, Last Temptation of Christ, is that once he's being crucified and he's up on the cross, he has this vision of what would his life be if he hadn't accepted God's commandment. And that's the part that really inflamed the right-wing establishment. Christians were very upset because it shows him with Mary Magdalene, you know, in the throes of embrace and, you know, having a child and what life would be like. And, it's all meant to be hypothetical. It's just like, hey, if I didn't accept what God wanted for me, this is what my life would have been. I would have been a carpenter. I would have got married. I would have had kids. I would have lived my life. And instead, I'm going to resist the last temptation. And the last shot is him being crucified, and he says the words, "It is accomplished." They weren't sure what they were going to end it with. Should it be "It is accomplished" or "It is done"? Peter Gabriel did the score. It's kind of eclectic. It was good. But Last Temptation of Christ, I think it has its virtues. I don't think it stands up with his other films. There are those who think it's a masterpiece. But Sanzik, have you ever seen Last Temptation of Christ?
I haven't, but it sounds like you have it on the low end of Marty films.
Yeah, it's not one that I easily cling to. It's not one that if I see it on TV, I'd want to see it again. Like I said, there's sequences and parts that I enjoy. I think to appreciate his filmography, it's important to see it, but I don't think it really hits the mark as much as it should. And this is the danger now with passion projects. So Passion Project, Last Temptation of Christ, Mean Streets, Gangs of New York, and now Silence. So I hope it all works out. So earlier I reviewed the film Audrey and Daisy, gave it 3.5 Maple Leafs. It's an excellent documentary currently streaming on Netflix, and a real thrill to have one of the directors of the film, Bonnie Cohen, who directed it along with her husband, John Shank. Bonnie, thanks so much for coming on Cinephile.
I'm happy to. Thanks for having me.
You know, Audrey and Daisy, when I was talking about it, I realized maybe the audience is thinking, hang on a second, why do I want to watch this documentary about three cases of rape and two American high school students, and one of whom undergoes tragic consequences because of what happens to her, and the other one emerges as a survivor but clearly is impacted by it. What would be the best reason you're giving to people to see this? So somebody who says, listen, I don't want to see that kind of subject matter, what is your response to them?
It's kind of a multi-pronged response. I've had that a lot as well. We hear a lot of people say to us, you know, oh, I really didn't want to see that film. I heard about it. I struggled because of the subject matter. But then I saw it, and it was such an emotional, impactful, and I know this is a strange thing to say, but beautiful experience. Because while it's very difficult to see, it's important, and maybe one of the more urgent issues of our time. And so it's sort of incumbent upon us all to get together and watch it, as difficult as it is, so that we can have conversations about what's happening.
And what's unique, Bonnie, about your film is the fact it shows how cyberbullying has become a real issue now in today's society. And, you know, these issues of sexual assault had happened in the past, and I'm sure that the shame and humiliation the victims felt was powerful, but it was done at a different level. You go to school, and it's written on your locker, and people are passing notes to you, et cetera. The way that this film shows and really accurately depicts is how painful it is when it's being done on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and anonymous comments are being thrown and just vicious comments and insults are being hurled your direction, how you deal with that. How did you disseminate, going through what happened to both Audrey and Daisy, what material you should show, and at what point do you feel like it's being sensationalistic to just pile on and show, look at this, this is what these two girls were facing, this is what you need to know what was happening to them?
Well, that's a great question. We spent a lot of time trying to kind of titrate that exact balance because, at a certain point, you know, a viewer could go numb if they were experiencing too much of that. But what we really tried to do, and this is how we used the advice of our own teenagers and their friends, we wanted to get the role of social media in the film just right so that teenagers actually related to it. So we spent a lot of time kind of figuring out how to depict it almost as another character in the film. And in terms of the things that were said to Daisy and Audrey and Delaney, we wanted to give just enough so that you could have the feeling as a viewer as to how overwhelming that kind of barrage of commentary could be on your own psychology should it be happening to you. And then if you can imagine yourself as a teenager where, you know, your brain is still developing and you're trying to make good decisions and have good judgment, if that kind of stream of commentary was coming at you, what kind of effect it would have. So we wanted to do just enough of it to have that effect, but not too much to turn it into kind of a sensationalized, almost ridiculous amount. So everything that you see on screen in terms of the social media, those are actual comments and conversations from the transcripts of the accounts of those girls.
Talking right now with Bonnie Cohen, who is the co-director, along with her husband John Shank, of the film Audrey and Daisy, that documentary currently available right now on Netflix. Bonnie, what's also appalling is not only the acts that are committed, but the criminal justice system. And I've always kind of known tangentially that sexual assault is something that's incredibly difficult to prosecute. But seeing your film, it really calls into attention that these guys are committing vile, heinous acts and yet are getting absolute wrist slaps. How did you deal with the indignation of seeing what the punishment is for these guys?
You know, that's really hard because it's incredibly frustrating and the injustices are so real. And, of course, through the making of the film, I think what became very apparent to us in our dealings with the families who have gone through this is that trying to get justice through the courts, through our legal system for these kinds of cases is really an uphill battle. They're very hard cases to prove and to litigate and to find justice. So, you know, one of the reasons we made the film was to kind of show some alternatives to the justice system, you know, show how you can take your own life in your hands and become an activist and find other girls or boys who have been through something like this and find support that way, because it is a very frustrating legal proposition. I don't know what to say other than we made the film for that reason. The frustration that we felt over the injustices is why we went into this subject to begin with. So, I think that there's a very kind of interesting balance and walk, you know, tightrope to be walked between finding justice, but also remembering that, you know, in a number of these cases, certainly at least one in the film we made, the boys are really young. You know, this happened when they were 14, 15 years old, and so you have to be really careful about how to handle juveniles, of course. And I think we all, John and I, came away feeling that rehabilitation for these boys and girls is the most important thing we can do as a society, and we're not sure it's really getting done.
Yeah, I think that raises the further point, Bonnie, the fact that, you know, like all great documentaries, which your film is, they expose the problem and they really show it in detail and in, at times, excruciating detail, but what's important to see is revealed. The counter to that then becomes, okay, what is the solution? How do we deal with the issue of sexual assault in this country and what the punishment is? What did you come away from thinking about that issue?
You know, that's also a great question, and we hope that people watch the film and come away with some hope, not necessarily, you know, concrete solutions, but a path towards solution. What we found is that, you know, early education of our boys and girls is essential around issues of sexual assault, sexual relationships, but it's also essential around the use of social media, and that is something that we're just getting our heads around in this country. We don't really have a core curriculum around how to use social media. And we're finding that, you know, the earlier you can get in with kids, 6th, 7th grade, even earlier in some cases, and start to talk to them about these issues, this kind of thing doesn't happen. It's the conversations that parents and teachers and adults, coaches, can be having with their kids that can help prevent this kind of behavior. So that's number one. And number two is, I think there's a character in the film, Charlie Coleman, who is Daisy's older brother, who is seen in the film working with, he's an athlete and he's a coach, he's a baseball coach for Little League. And you see him in the film working with his younger players, and you hear him talk about how he likes to talk to his boys about, you know, behavior towards girls, et cetera, that happen kind of naturally in the course of their conversations. And we hope that that kind of serves as an example, as a model for what boys can do, how they can find support for each other, how they can help guide each other, how they can, because, you know, a lot of most boys out there are good boys. They're not, you know, these boys don't start out wanting to commit these crimes and do this kind of thing. So I hope that, you know, people who watch the film can see Charlie as kind of a leader in the kind of community of men doing the right thing.
Yeah, no doubt. He's a good dude, and you can tell he's a protective brother, but also somebody who seems level-headed, which is unfortunately a quality which seems to be lacking among most these days. Last one for you, yeah. Bonnie. What do you think the state is of documentaries? For all those would-be documentarians out there, how tough is it right now to get these films made?
Well, I think it's a really, you know, we really feel, we've been doing this a long time, and we feel that there's a real renaissance going on in documentary right now. There are so many more platforms, Netflix, Amazon, these digital online platforms where you can release your films. There are many more opportunities and outlets for content. So I think we see this as a really interesting and important time for documentary film. There's a lot of interest in it. I think people are turning towards these kinds of movies for a real experience. And, you know, there are many more places to see them and experience them. So we're feeling very positive about the state of the industry from a documentary perspective.
Yeah, I know the film definitely had a warm reception at Sundance earlier this year. Currently available on Netflix, Audrey and Daisy. Check it out. Bonnie Cohen, John Shank, the co-directors. Thanks so much, Bonnie. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast, Cinephile. As always, we really appreciate you listening. Coming up next time, we're going to have J.K. Simmons, who's fantastic. Met him at Celebrity Softball in San Diego. He's a great guy. He's going to have funny stories. His new film, The Accountant, is coming up, and I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.